You'll know real when you get it. It will say eBay Authenticity Guarantee, and you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like a gem, sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. When it comes to style and luxury, eBay gets it. They're making sure the things that you love are checked by experts. Not just any experts, specialized experts. Real people who love this stuff with real hands-on authentication experience. So when you see that shiny blue check mark that says authenticity guarantee, shop with confidence. Every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is verified authentic through a detailed inspection. That's how you know eBay's got your back. Because when you finally step into those sneakers, put on that watch, get your real gold glow up, swing that handbag over your shoulder, or step out in that streetwear, you'll realize that feeling is unlike any other. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms. Hello, hello. It's Brooke Devard, and you're listening to the Naked Beauty Podcast. Happy Black History Month. We're at the very tail end. Listen, for me, every month is Black History Month. It's not just contained in February, but a lot of great things have happened this month for Black excellence. Black Panther, of course. I just saw it. I cannot believe how amazing that movie was, how beautiful the set design was, the costume design, the hair, the makeup, the actors are just stunning. You're just sitting there like so enchanted the whole time. And I don't even like superhero movies, to be very clear. I actually hate action, sci-fi. That's not a genre I typically identify with, but I loved Black Panther. One of the things I appreciated most about Black Panther was the costume design. I've read every single interview I can with the costume designer, Ruth Carter. She is a legend. She's done a lot of Spike Lee films. She just goes above and beyond. It's one of those professions that I feel like if I didn't do what I do now, I would have been a costume designer because I love film, I love storytelling, I love history, I love fashion, and you kind of get to combine all of those things, but wow. Well, the script was incredible. Ryan Coogler, I think he's like 31 years old. I cannot believe what a master of his craft he is already. I think this is the beginning of a franchise similar to what Star Wars is, and I just couldn't be happier about the film. Of course, this month, former President Barack Obama and former First Lady Michelle Obama had their portraits revealed. President Obama's portrait done by Kehinde Wiley is so stunningly beautiful. What else happened in February? Oh, Drake gave away $1 million in his music video for God's Plan. Let's put that in Black excellence. A lot of Black models in Fashion Week this year, more so than in previous seasons. The Prada show just made history. Let me get the names right. But yes, last night, model Anouk Yai made history at Prada's Fall 2018 show during Milan Fashion Week. The 19-year-old became the second Black model to ever open a Prada show. The first was Naomi Campbell back in 1997. So that means it's been literally over 2 decades since a Black model opened the show. I'm happy that Prada is finally seeing the light. Diversity on the runway is a really positive trend that I hope to continue to see. Today's show is about Black history of the past. I got to interview Nichelle Gaynor, who I have admired for years and years and years, back when vintage Black glamour was just online before she started doing her books. I've always been really drawn to the past. I've always been drawn to women like Josephine Baker, of course, and all of the kind of muses and actresses and musicians from former decades. They just had this kind of allure and glamour to them that you don't see as much anymore. And Nichelle is just, I think she calls herself at one point in the episode like the Black History Encyclopedia. Her knowledge is just so deep, and I loved talking to her. I could have talked to her for hours. Actually, to be fair, she stayed after we recorded and we talked for hours and hours more, but she is just so interesting. I love the perspective that she brought to the show. You guys are going to learn so much listening to this episode. I was learning throughout the conversation. The show notes are very in-depth, as always. And, you know, Black history is American history, and a lot of this is women's history. It's, you know, just history of culture, and it's so important to understand the past in order to know where we're going and what the future could hold. I hope you guys love this episode. Thank you so much for listening. Stay healthy, stay hydrated, make sure you're moisturizing, you know, getting lots of sleep. Spring is around the corner. I couldn't be more excited about that. Really, really excited to share this episode with you guys. All right.
I'm sitting here with Nichelle of Vintage Black Glamour, which I have been following and loving. Was it? I was still in college, so it must have been 2010?
11.
11. Okay.
Close.
Close. But I remember just like image after image of these super glamorous, beautiful black men and women from every decade just inspiring me. And I remember the book came out. I have the book on my coffee table that I just showed you. So I'm honored to have you on the show. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you, Brooke. I'm honored to be here.
Yes. And it's Black History Month, which is like, I'm like, every day is black. Like every month is Black History Month.
Especially on Vintage Black Glamour. I always say
yes.
That. I haven't said that on, haven't posted yet. that particular phrase that I say all the time, but yeah, every day, you know, every day, every month, all the time.
Yes.
Put it back in the textbooks and
yes.
keep it there.
And keep it there. Exactly. What inspired you to create Vintage Black Glamour, which is an amazing name, by the way?
Thank you. It just came to me one day because initially I was writing fiction. It was inspired by two of my aunts. Okay. One aunt that I've known all my life and one that I discovered a little later.
Okay.
So I was in the Schomburg, uptown
in Harlem.
I was researching a novel that is still in my back pocket.
Okay.
Kind of inspired by my aunt Mildred Taylor, who is pictured in the back of the book. She's the aunt in the back.
Okay.
And she modeled in the 50s, you know, black women in the 50s. You know, we had our whole... a whole circuit of fashion shows and
yes.
beauty contests
yes.
that were black only because the mainstream things at that time explicitly did not permit black contestants.
Right.
The Miss America contest had the infamous rule number 7.
What's that? What's rule number 7?
That contestants must be at least 21 years of age in good health and of the white race.
Wow. Like they explicitly said that?
That was in writing, yes.
Wow. Yeah. And that's the 50s.
Yeah, it's that. Yeah, pretty they finally.
Recent. That's pretty recent history.
Yeah, and they finally stopped that explicit rule in 1950. Actually, it was Miss America started like back in the early 20s or mm-hmm. something, and it stopped. That rule technically stopped in 1950, but no black women locally black women competed,
mm-hmm.
but no black woman really got to the national contest before 1970.
Mm.
And of course, the first black winner was Vanessa Williams,
of course.
And for 1984 was 1983. I remember it specifically because I'm from South Jersey.
Okay.
And so South Jersey near Philadelphia, which is also near Atlantic City.
Okay.
So our local newspapers would have the Miss America contest preliminaries in the paper. And that year there were four or five black contestants and a Latina.
Oh.
So it was, and Miss New Jersey was black at
okay.
the time, but even though she was, you know, I was from New Jersey, even at that time, I was rooting for Miss New York.
Yeah.
I've always liked Vanessa Williams, even from that time.
Yeah.
And she won. You know how you see people and you just know.
No,
and I just
like there's
knew,
something about her.
I'm not surprised that she's still famous because you can
feel that energy.
Yeah. Some people just have that thing. But anyway, that's, you know.
That's the genesis of it.
Yeah, and Miss USA, those same, you know, Miss Universe, the same thing. That was more international, mm-hmm. obviously, Miss Universe.
Mm-hmm.
So you had a black winner as early as 1977 from Trinidad and Tobago.
Oh, wow.
Janelle Comisson.
I did not know that.
Yeah, yeah. I really wanted a picture of her in the book, but I couldn't find a good quality one. I
yes.
don't just, yeah, I like good quality pictures.
Yes,
and
the photography in the books is beautiful.
Yeah, thank you. And I just couldn't get a good one in time.
Yes.
She still looks amazing, but she was the first black winner in
okay.
1977, and she was in a lot of different ads, and there are great pictures of her with Michael Jackson and
yeah.
other celebrities in the day. And so it was not as unusual at that point, but in the 50s, especially locally, we were on our own. Church
yeah.
fashion shows, yes. independent owners of beauty salons,
mm-hmm.
and just, you know, we had our own thing. And so that's what my aunt did locally.
Okay.
And she was also a singer, so they had, that was her talent, you know,
right.
for the talent contest
right.
held in Indianapolis. And she told me that the representative from New York was Diane Carroll.
Wow. That's major.
Yeah. So, I mean,
well, we should give background because some people, and this is the thing that I'm realizing. I love history. I love especially black history. And that's why I think I connected with your site. It's funny that you mentioned the Schomburg because I was so fascinated by the Harlem Renaissance and I ended up writing a lot about it in college. And so I'd always have to go to the Schomburg because the Schomburg is like the ultimate library for anything related to Harlem, especially the Harlem Renaissance. Who is Diane Carroll and why is she such an important figure?
Oh, Diane Carroll, the majestic Diane Carroll. Born in the Bronx.
Is she from the Bronx? I didn't know that.
Yes. Her first name is actually Carol. She was born Carol Diane Johnson, and she eventually
flipped it.
Yes. But she started out as a teenage model. She modeled for Ebony back in the day. Yeah. She comes from a very, you know, kind of, I won't say conservative, but, you know, from a traditional type home, mom and pop, who wanted her to go to college and get married and do all the traditional things. And she wanted to do her thing. And
show
she
business.
Did. Yeah. Yes. So she, you know, she studied, you know, dance and acting, obviously. And she did Broadway in the early 50s. And, you know, just always just honing her craft and skill and her image and the whole thing. And it was also her, and, you know, it was one thing to hone it, but she also had that naturally, the elegance, the whole thing. She was one of, it's a weird little factoid, though, but she was the first Black guest to sit down on a Tonight Show, to have to sit as a guest.
Wow.
And you know how I know that weird little fact? Because Jack Parr, who was like the first host of the Tonight Show, he wrote about it in his autobiography.
As like this 80s. Moment, like there was a Black person on the show. And what year was this that she was the first
person? It was supposed to be, I think it was like 1959, 60, somewhere in that range. Like Dick Gregory was like the second. Some people said that he was the first, but according to Jack Parr, it was Diane Carroll. Yeah, but it was random because Jack Parr said, well, you know, I realized that we had a lot of Black guests on our show, but they never sat down on the couch with me, and I just thought it was kind of weird. So when she was in Carmen Jones, that's the...
Okay.
She was one of Dorothy Dandridge's friends. And Pearl Bailey was in it. Carmen DeLavala was one of the dancers. Next,
Carmen,
Roach was there.
I learned about Carmen from your site. So this is the thing that I love about your content. So they're obviously the icons of, you know, vintage Black glamour that everyone knows, right?
Yes.
Who would be like the most, who's like Eartha Kitt, maybe?
Josephine Baker, Eartha Kitt.
Josephine Baker, the icon of
Dorothy
this
Dandridge and Lena Horne. I call them the four goddesses because those are the main ones that, in fact, initially in early versions of Vintage Black Glamour, the book, I actually had a chapter called The Goddesses.
The Goddesses.
Where I was just
who are they again? Let me just make sure I have the goddesses
my
right.
My goddesses. That's the way I put it. Josephine Baker, Lena Horne, Dorothy Dandridge, and Eartha Kitt.
Eartha Kitt,
Those are the ones who are the most well-known by everyone.
Yes.
Not just Black audience. Even though, be surprised, Summer. I mean, you're
I'm 28.
You're 28.
But I love history, and I feel like spirit aligns
That's
more.
That's why I like you, Brooke, because you'd be surprised at how many 28-year-olds
don't know a lot of things. I know.
When I was 28, I knew these things, and I didn't have the internet. I mean, we had the internet, but the internet was not as vast as it is.
Right. That's why your work is so important, right? Because you're exposing people to this history that we can't afford to lose.
Well, that's why I started it in the first place.
So, okay, the goddesses. Is it true that, I think it was Dorothy Dandridge that I was reading this about, or maybe it was Lena Horne, that Marilyn Monroe like modeled herself after...
I wouldn't say that she modeled herself. From what I understand, they were friendly. They were friends. Dorothy Dandridge and Marilyn Monroe?
They were friends? About,
yeah. Because okay. they were at least friendly, according to Dorothy Dandridge. And one of her autobiographies, the one that I think Earl Mills kind of tweaked or whatever. But I think Donald Bogle, in his definitive biography on her, I think he mentions it as well. They took acting classes together at the Actors Studio in L.A. That was a very liberal place. It was so liberal that it was investigated by the government for being communist because they allow Blacks and Latinos.
Scandal.
You imagine? So they had Blacks and whites were fraternizing, apparently taking acting classes and enjoying each other's company. And so, they both took classes at that time. And from what I understand, I don't think there was any rivalry or any,
Okay.
Yeah. And during that time, really, Marilyn Monroe was already, were they both coming up at them? Carmen Jones hit in like 1954 or so, but Marilyn Monroe was already kind of coming up to fame as well at that time. They kind of like peaked around the same time in different things.
Yeah.
Obviously, Marilyn Monroe was much more famous, but they were fine. They were friendly from what I understand.
They were contemporaries.
The hard thing for me is I wish you don't hear as many stories, and I certainly haven't found any pictures of people like Lena Horne and Dorothy Dandridge in the same picture.
Right. Yeah, did they hang out?
Not that I've ever heard of. Because also, I mean, Lena Horne is also like a decade older than her.
So, she's 10 years older, okay.
Yeah, and more famous in different circles. I mean, we're not monolith, right? So they all have different circles. Even yes. though sometimes they shared the same vocal coach, Phil Moore, who's also in my men's book. He was a vocal coach for Marilyn Monroe and
interesting
Dorothy Dandridge, but also people like Sinatra and Judy Garland, from what I understand. So he trained basically everybody.
Yes, he was the guy.
Yeah, the book in my the picture of him in my men's book. I purposely put a picture of him with Marilyn Monroe because I talked about him in the other ones, but okay. That'd be a great little play, or like a little, you know, a short story, something of someone like him, some integral people like that who were like behind the scenes training these legends that we know.
Okay. Yeah. There are like so many podcasts/documentaries that I think you should make, but the behind the scenes people are so fascinating to me. I remember when I was studying the Harlem Renaissance, learning about James Van Der Zee, who pretty much photographed the entire Renaissance, right?
And then some.
So much of our understanding of what the Harlem Renaissance is and was is from his photographs. And imagine if he wasn't around to take them. And then I also remember learning about Carl van Vechten, who was white and German, and he also photographed a lot.
Interesting fellow. Most of the color pictures in my book, well, especially the ones that are much older. Are by Carl van Vechten.
Yeah, because this is the 20s, what we're talking
Absolutely.
About.
Absolutely. So. Gosh, why am I blanking on her name? But she was the Harlem, the it girl of a Harlem Renaissance, I called her. And she went to all the parties, black and white, uptown and downtown.
There was some girl I remember reading about. Is it Alea? She had a big house and she would always have all these parties. She was also bisexual. Alela Walker?
Oh, Alelia.
Alelia.
Yeah, sorry, Madam C.J. Walker's daughter.
That's Madam C.J. Walker's daughter?
Yes, yes.
So, okay, what was her deal?
My friend Alelia's
I feel like we're gossiping about people from like the times, but like, what was her deal?
Nothing. If she was in the book, well, the daughter was in the book, Alelia Walker. So
yes.
She was the, you know.
So her mother was a millionaire, the first black millionaire, Madam C.J. Walker.
First black, I mean, the first self-made woman, too.
Period. Black, white. The first woman to become
self-made. Not inherited from daddy.
Yes. and it was because she was selling relaxer, pretty much.
Well, what they hoped was relaxer. I don't know what it was. You know, it was
a hair straightening.
Some type of hair potion.
A hair potion,
I think
that's
kind.
Yes.
She sold skin products. She sold different things, you know, just trying to beautify, trying to help. She had a beauty school.
Yes.
She's an entrepreneur. She, you know, she started out as a washerwoman.
Wow.
And she made all this money, obviously a multimillionaire. Mm-hmm. And she had a place up in Harlem, somewhere in the 130s, not far from, near Stryver's Row. She also bought a home in Westchester in Irvington.
Oh, wow.
Hudson.
Good for
Villa Loaro, it's called.
Okay.
And that's where they'd have like a lot of infamous parties there as well.
Yes.
She had infamous parties in Harlem.
She was infamous and her daughter was.
No, the daughter.
The daughter.
I'm talking about her daughter. Madam Walker died by this time, like in the early. Yeah,
so she was long gone.
This was the daughter, the one who was like the patron of the arts and spendthrift.
And what year is this?
I want to say late 20s, early 30s, right in the Harlem Renaissance.
30s. But I remember reading that she was bisexual, which, like, I didn't know was even acceptable.
There are quite a few flexible people there. Whether they were bisexual, you know, they were, you know, I like to say flexible because it's one thing for what
they
say.
But they were living in the 20s, like.
Yeah, but they were, it depends on who you're talking about, the circles that you're in.
Yes,
so
true.
They were, she had, like, these bathtub gin parties.
Yes.
She had parties where she had one party, some infamous party, where the white people were served like pig's feet and hog maws, and the black people were served champagne and caviar.
Yes.
Like, she would just do things like that.
Oh,
you
my
know?
God. I wish she was around today so I could follow her on Instagram.
Yes.
Could you imagine? You know, like,
I wish all of these people were
around. I know.
God, all the people, I mean, and like you said, and all of the interesting ones, the most interesting ones were, like you say, they were like, you know, sexually fluid.
Yes.
They were culturally fluid.
Right.
Spoke different languages.
Yes.
Knew all kinds of people. The type of way, you know, the way that we think we of ourselves now, that we fancy ourselves.
Yes. We think we're so like advanced and modern, but it's like people have been far more progressive.
And even people who could barely afford to, that's when the vice squad can knock on your door and arrest you for homosexuality or arrest you for whatever they felt like. Even more openly now, and there was no Instagram or Facebook video to save you.
It was
what it was, you know? So it was, she threw all these great parties, but she was also a philanthropist, you know, she She was an interesting person. There's going to be a movie about her, do you know?
Oh, there is? Oh,
well, about Madam C.J. Not her, I'm sorry, but about her mother, about Madam C.J. Walker. Yeah. Octavia Spencer is going to star.
Oh, good. You know what? Producing. So I just saw The Shape of Water. I haven't seen it yet. It's fantastic. I love Guillermo del Toro. I love Octavia Spencer, but I was like, you are another cleaning lady in the sixth. Like, I just feel like I would love to see more roles about the type of people that you've been doing.
I would, and I'm like, sure she would too. That's why she's producing this thing.
Oh, she's producing
working with
it
Ilelia,
too.
With Ilelia Bundles, who's a friend of mine actually.
Oh, wow.
And she's the one who wrote the definitive biography on Madam C.J. Walker.
Oh, good.
It's called On Our Own. Oh, forgive me, Ilelia, for forgetting the name of it.
Oh, I need to read that.
You should, because this definitive one, she's the only expert on her own great grandmother,
yes.
Great great grandmother, I think. And she was a producer at ABC, like in the 80s and 90s, whatever. She's a journalist. And so she's not just some family member like, oh, let me preserve legacy. She's a professional.
Yes.
And so she's been preserving this for a while, and she waited. And so I'm glad to see that she's working with Octavia Spencer on this.
Amazing.
She's really...
Okay, I can't
really
wait
great.
For that.
She's the one that gave me permission to use the picture in my book of Ilelia.
Hey, let me... This is a very tough question that I'm going to ask you, only because I tried to answer it myself and it was too hard. But what would you say your favorite decade is? Like, are you 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s?
Well, before I answer it, I just thought about something that I meant to say before when we were talking about Octavia Spencer.
Yes.
Octavia Spencer, like a lot of black actresses before her, like Teresa Harris, who was in my book, who was an actress in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, they all wanted to do other roles outside of playing maids, but sometimes you take the job. And
absolutely.
So I don't fault them for that.
Yeah,
get in there. And so I understand where she's coming from. I know they got a lot of criticism for The Help and the whole thing, which is a whole nother... let's not even go there. But I'm just being a little, as far as what... Octavia Spencer and actresses, you know, of that caliber who don't have the look of a Halle Berry or a Gabrielle Union or whatever, they're not going to get these roles. We know what it is, whether it's a black film or a white film or whatever. So they take the job, they get in, and then they make moves like she's making with this. You know, Harriet.
Where you can be the boss and call the shots. Yeah,
exactly. Hattie McDaniel famously said, I'd rather play a maid for $700 a week than be a maid for $7 a week.
Amen.
And so there, I can understand getting in where you fit in and doing what you have to do.
Sure.
And there's so much great work going on with black actors finally being able and being more visible about producing other projects and whether they're working with other artists or doing it themselves. And so exciting.
It's a very exciting time. I agree. Is it true that Lena Horne said, I cannot play a slave?
Well, it's sort of, not so much a slave, but her father didn't want her to play maids.
Okay.
In her MGM contract, she was like the second black actress to get an MGM contract. Nina Mae McKinney was the first.
Okay.
And Lena Horne's father didn't, and Lena Horne herself, I mean, she didn't want to play maids roles, which kind of put her in a weird position because other black actors, according to Ms. Horne.
This is the 40s, right?
Yes. And so, 30s, 40s.
30s,
and so
40s,
According to Ms. Horne, a lot of the black actors in Hollywood kind of resented her because they were doing those jobs. And here she was coming to Hollywood.
Saying like, oh, I'm kind of above it.
Yes. And they're like, who do you think you are? You know,
right.
And so you're taking jobs from us and you don't want to do these type of things. And so she kind of had a hard time of it. There's a great, if you have time, there's a great interview with her on Dick Cavett's show.
Oh.
And like the
on YouTube?
Yes.
Okay, I'll link to it in the show notes so people can check it out too.
It's fascinating. I've linked it a couple times in Vintage Black Glamour, like little clips of it. But if you listen to her talk about people, and she talks about Hattie McDaniel and Ethel Waters, the ladies who, you know, they like diamonds and furs too, but they were playing washroom women. So,
yes.
I mean, it's really interesting to hear it from that perspective and not in the time where you're trying to be politically correct or be, you're just answering the question. So the talk shows from the 70s and 80s are the best because people were more honest.
Yes, they really were. Yeah. Like,
there wasn't any pushback and any controversy where they had to come and apologize and make a statement. I mean, granted, people do need to do that because a lot of messed up stuff going on. So many little things in interviews in the 70s, 80s, and the 60s.
Oh,
people were getting so much trouble for now.
I know.
I mean, some things they should.
Yes, James Baldwin is someone where you look at his interviews on talk shows and you're like, if there was this level of discourse now, I would of course watch, but because now it's like these pre-rehearsed weird, it's like almost like actors are doing these like bits, like these comedy bits.
And at that time,
not good.
You're talking about a time in television where people expected a certain intelligence level. not to be snobby, but they kind of expected that on television. They kind of, and it wasn't quote unquote, people weren't looking to see quote unquote regular people all the time. Oh, let me be folksy and relate to them.
Right.
You can be whatever. If you were an intellectual, you were an intellectual. Right. You were on this talk show or that talk show. You did that. It wasn't about trying to appeal to the masses or have a statement. Not that people didn't prepare and didn't have things ready to go, but it was more that it was new. It was newer, being, you know, beamed into people's homes all over the country at that time, not so much worldwide yet.
Yeah.
But it was still new, and so people, it was more of a, you know, they were trying out different things. They didn't know it worked. Mm-hmm. It, you know, they were some of the first shows.
Yes.
So it was kind of an interesting time, and so like a, you're not going to see like another Dick Cavett show again.
Probably not. Well, I think a lot of that is kind of where podcasting has come in, right? For those long-form conversations where you can get deeper than what's the latest project you have.
Especially, if you have someone interesting and they bring in interesting people, especially if they have a certain kind of inside baseball kind of knowledge about it. Like, I listen to a lot of screenwriting podcasts, like I was telling you. And so you have these people who are screenwriters, not today, not 20 years ago. They're screenwriters right now. And they're talking to other screenwriters or TV writers or producers who are doing things now.
Yep.
And people who have, like, maybe 5 years experience, maybe people who've had 30 years experience. So you get a wide range of interesting people. And some are stiffer than others, but some people are very natural and interesting on these podcasts. So I like to listen to them. And so, especially when I'm moving around, when I'm walking down the street or driving or something.
But don't you think it'd be so amazing to have a podcast that explored all of the backgrounds of the people that you cover in your books? Almost like a historical podcast.
Yeah, I've been kind of thinking about it because,
amazing.
Every now and then people ask me about that. But as you know, doing a podcast is a lot of work.
Yes. No, I know.
So I have a lot of respect for it. And there's some other things I'm trying to, get together now. So I don't want to. You don't want to go halfway. You want to go
all the
way. I have a name for it and the whole thing, but
okay.
The domains, but it's just a matter of getting of the right time for it and doing it well.
Yes. Well, we've talked a lot about your work. I'd love to know a little bit more about you and, kind of how you grew up and what it was like, where you were from.
Well, I'm from New Jersey.
Okay.
I am from South Jersey near Philadelphia.
Okay.
I was born in Newark, actually, as were both of my parents. But when I was an infant, they moved to South Jersey. My father was going to college down there.
Okay.
And so I grew up down there near Philadelphia. And so New Jersey, it's kind of weird. I'm not sure about other states, but we didn't have our own radio and TV per se. You have it now on cable, but in South Jersey you listen to Philadelphia radio, you watch Philadelphia TV, and like just like in North Jersey in New York, you're watching New York radio
television. Isn't Wendy Williams from Jersey?
Yes, she is.
She is.
I forget where, but I know she's from New Jersey because
she says it
quite a bit. Yeah,
I love Wendy. Okay, sorry.
Yeah, no, I like Wendy Williams. She's from New Jersey, and it's funny. A lot of things she says, it's kind of familiar because she's definitely from Jersey.
Yeah,
but
you grew up in Jersey. What kind of school did you go to?
Public schools, regular, random.
So it was mixed. White kids, black kids.
Yes, and it's interesting that you say that because I grew up. Elementary school, I grew up, in the 70s, late 70s, I was in the elementary school.
Okay.
All black school in Lawnside, New Jersey. Lawnside is, I don't know about now, I think it's still black, but it's an historic black town.
Oh, interesting.
And so, in fact, one of the participants of the Harlem Renaissance, Jessie Fawcett, from that era. She's from
Lawnside,
from whatever the original name of Lawnside was, she's from that town.
Yes.
And so, but Lawnside is like, I grew up like in the 70s with Bob Marley on the radio and Marvin Gaye and Rant. And I went to like an all black elementary school from kindergarten all the way up to third grade until we moved to a different town. And it was interesting because this was like, I remember specifically it was like 79, 80 or so. And so,
what was that in third grade to go from being around all black kids?
I went home the first day of the white and black school. I'm like, Mom, guess what? My teacher's white. And it wasn't like a big deal because, it's interesting. That's why, I don't have kids. But I tell you, however you raise your kids, it shows up. Because my mother never raised me to say white people like this, black people like
this. Right, yeah.
So I was never like, oh my God. I was just like, oh, wow, hey, white people.
She has a different color skin. You're right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I knew a bit, but growing up in the black town, that black bubble kind of, it was kind of great because there was a little store. There was a man named Mr. Delaney who had like a little like a little store where he sold like pickles for 25 cents. Seriously.
Yeah.
So I'm sure that's the last of that. I don't think even in the 80s and 90s those type of stores existed. Mm-hmm. You know, the school that I went to, there was also like the high school, so you had all the cool kids and everything. And so to hear all of the teachers were Mrs. Crawford owned. It was a nursery school, quote unquote, but it was basically like a babysitting service. So you had like kindergarten, but up to like fourth, fifth, whatever grade, you know, parents dropped their kids off at this school. And so it was interesting being in that type of thing where they were like black business owners and black teachers, where it was not unusual. It wasn't weird to see a black banker or a teacher or whatever. And then going to the white school was interesting too, because first of all, one thing I'll say about growing up too, which is weird, which it doesn't happen anymore because I don't think kids play dolls and that type of thing, or a TV show, acting out TV shows. You don't have to.
But yeah, they're all on their iPads, which is just a whole different.
I'm sure there's many other black women my age, or non-white women, that can tell you about playing Charlie's Angels as a kid. and that's where color came in, whereas it wasn't always as apparent. But now this is an all-black environment. So the light-skinned girls, they were the ones that played Chris or Kelly.
Right.
The darker ones had to be Sabrina. So I was always Sabrina. Darker or the nerdier girls. So
got it.
Always Sabrina. Because Sabrina wasn't like the sexy one. She was more smart and like more.
Got it.
Yeah.
Can I tell you the millennial version of that? It's the Spice Girls. So I was always Scary Spice. Default, right? I was like, well, I like Posh and I like her style and I like little
you
black
had
dresses.
To be Scary Spice.
But you're black, you're Scary Spice.
That's it.
Go in the corner over there and be Scary Spice. Yes, so
I'll bet 90% of black girls in my generation were Sabrina. Unless they were really light and they were with other black kids. If you're with white girls, then God, you were probably Sabrina. But the light skinned girls were Chris and Kelly. And it wasn't like it was just a thing, but it wasn't like traumatizing, but it was just a thing.
Yeah.
You know, we had Wonder Woman at time, Linda Carter's Wonder Woman.
Yes.
So, I mean, you played Wonder Woman. I wore glasses even at that time, so I'd take my glasses off and like, spin around like Wonder Woman. So, you know, that's the 70s and the 80s you're growing up with. There was an Asian kid in my class, and there was another black girl who, when I walked into class, she's smiling at me big, like, hi.
Yeah, you're like, hey, one more.
But it was fine. It was, you know, it was fine. And it was interesting, as I got to be a teenager, I was kind of disappointed in movies like The Breakfast Club and things like that, where they didn't have any black kids.
Right.
So I'm like, I'm in a school with black and white kids, so why are all these things all white? Why is everybody only white?
Well, it's like, we're in 2018, Girls is off the air, but when Girls was on, it was like they're living in New York City and everyone's white.
Well, and people said the same thing about Sex in the City when it came out.
Yeah,
because
and Friends, and I mean, it's like
all of it.
What
well,
universe
single
is
before Friends? But you know,
yeah, of course. Really, so when you were kind of like experimenting with your beauty look and coming into your own personal style, was this what the 90s, late 80s?
As an adult or a teenager?
Well, I think it's like coming into your own is like the end of high school.
Yeah, not much going on there. I was more like the nerdy one, reading, you know.
You were the smart girl.
I was a smart girl, was not the pretty girl. I, you know, sometimes my hair would be great, sometimes not. That was more, I'm so glad natural is a thing now.
You have
it's more
beautiful hair.
Because you have when I was growing, you had to have relaxed hair to be, you know, respectable, to be pretty, to have a nice look. I'll never forget when I was a kid, and from the time where I had like the little girl hair to the time I got my first relaxer, and how many compliments I got, and how
you're so pretty.
And I remember thinking, okay, but it was a thing.
Yeah,
it was a thing. So at that time, this is more like around the aging myself, but around the time of the Anita Baker haircut.
Okay,
you know, Anita Baker had that short cut before Halle Berry, famously. So it was around the time you go to the hairdresser and ask for that cut.
The Anita Baker.
It's a nice, simple thing. And of course, you had a lot of the salt and pepper hair, too, with the angled bobs and the whole thing, the shave. You
but
know.
Your hair, your natural hair is very long.
This is a little help here, but my own hair is as long as my extensions here.
It's
but
beautiful.
Yeah, I've been wearing this for a while. I've been natural since 2009.
Okay.
So my own hair is shoulder length like this hair, but it's just a nice protective way to do it because my hair, it's so delicate.
It's so much work. People don't understand.
And that's why I do this too, because it's not as much where I can just kind of do this blindfolded.
So I call it hair vacations. I'm like, I need a hair vacation.
This is a hair vacation.
Exactly.
Because if I have to think about doing my hair and it takes too much time.
Every single day, and the wash day and the deep conditioning and the detangling.
And this is not even good. This is not even like having my hair redone. I need to get it freshened. In fact,
no, it looks
so it's
very
not
good.
Even, you know.
It looks very
but
good.
It's, they have... my own hair, it would be so much more work and it wouldn't look as nice.
Right.
And so to have it like this hair from, I go to Comet Kinks in Brooklyn.
Oh, I always hear about this like natural, but it's so interesting. So you have braids in now. I always forget that people don't have a visual, but you have braids in now, but it looks like your own hair braided, right?
That's the idea. That's why it costs so much money, because it's supposed to look like your own hair.
But, their
quality hair that they get.
Their prices are a little bit crazy. Would you mind explaining how much you paid?
No.
Ballpark?
It's like, I think it's like $60. And the hair is like, whenever I always have to buy 4 or 5 ounces just to have it. And that's like $200, $240. Yep. That's just the hair alone.
That's just the hair, yeah. And then what's the installation?
And they've gone up on their price. When I lived in Asia last year and I came back and the price
Where in Asia were you living?
I lived in Bangkok. I was living in Bangkok and Seoul.
I loved it.
So, yeah, it was great. But it was $325. I think it's like $375 now.
Okay,
but
the thing $400 and $300 for hair. It's $700 for a hairstyle.
You get what you pay for, though. Because
that's true.
That's why what you just said, I get all the time. People would say, oh, it looks like your hair. Well, like, it is my hair, because the good thing about it is you can reuse it. So when they redo my hair, they can take this out, you know, wash it, you know, whatever, and just like my own hair, and put it back
in. Okay, I think I want to go to them. I need a hair vacation.
Yeah, you redo it. And so, Anu Prestonia owns it. She's a buddy of mine. I like her. Cool. She's owned that salon for years. She used to do Terry McMillan's hair and Stevie Wonder, you know, in those days. Angela Bassett, when she first started doing the natural styles, like a lot of the black celebrities that we saw in the 80s and 90s during the naturals, she was one of the main ones they were going to.
Oh, amazing.
So she's been around. She's been, before natural was a thing,
everyone
was doing it.
She was the original.
Yep.
Okay. Celebrities of the past that wore natural hair. One of the people that I always look at is Cicely Tyson.
I have a great video I'm about to post on Instagram soon.
Wait, what's the video? What's the context?
It's from Young, Gifted, and Black from 1969, Lorraine Hansberry.
Okay.
And I found a little clip on YouTube, and so I was thinking about posting it tonight. I'll probably post it tomorrow.
Okay.
It's just me doing...
Social media is, like, so successful. Gabrielle Union follows you. I know Tracy Ellis Ross, like, reposts. I mean, you're, like, killing it on...
Thank you, ladies.
Yes. Yeah, no, it's been great. I mean, I'm always looking for... So I love, you know, pictures from the past of, like, really glamorous black women, but it's hard to find women with natural hair because they all straightened their hair back then, for the most part. Or they were wearing wigs. Mm-hmm. It's hard to find...
And that's what they, you know, that was how you ate in those days. It was just the context of society.
Yeah.
So even if they want... If you were really an outlier if you were a black woman with Afro-textured hair and you were wearing your hair like Cicely Tyson, she was really distinctive.
Yes.
So women who had that type of look you didn't see every day.
Yeah. Besides Cicely Tyson, who really wore their hair natural?
More in the 70s. Once you got into the 60s and the 70s, and even then, you were still wearing, because you had the whole Black is Beautiful
Black
movement.
Black is Beautiful movement,
Angela Davis, with her iconic afro. And so you had that look of, you know... But even at that time, it's interesting because you had the Black is Beautiful, Don't Wear Makeup, Beautiful Sister. And then they would see the brothers going with the women who did wear makeup and everything. And so you had that. Context, just like any other time. Nothing is new. Yeah.
The Black is Beautiful movement, was that a beauty movement or was it a civil rights movement that translated into beauty?
Kind of like that, a mixture. It was a social movement. So it really kind of affected everything. I mean, you had like a lot of the civil rights victories from the 60s, and then you're coming into the 70s when you're new to all of this. You know, my stepmother talks about the time when she got her master's, like in the early 70s, where she says, oh, there were so many things open to black people at the time that were not open because people were, especially white people who were, you know, liberal and wanted to show how open they were, and they wanted to hire you, or they had a scholarship for you, and there were things going on, because especially after Dr. King died and the whole thing. And so especially that sweet spot between 68 and 71-ish, say.
Yes.
I mean, not that there weren't other things going on, obviously. There're never not things going on,
right.
But there was a time where is this Black is Beautiful, where is black women, black men too, but especially black women who were really beholden as far as this makeup and trying to look, you know, a certain way, not just prettier, but look like a different race.
You whiter.
Look whiter.
Yes.
You know, to have straighter hair,
yes.
to have lighter skin.
Yes.
The skin, the the skin bleaching ads were really
when did those stop?
Until I'd say the early 70s, they stopped.
Wow, and really, I didn't realize
but
that.
They actually, were... they still have them, but they just changed the wording of it. So
right.
they were blatant. And if you look at some of the early ad, the ads from the 60s and the 70s, the ads would say, "Look lighter, get a date." It was that blatant.
No,
it was hilarious. I don't put those on Vintage Black Glamour typically because I don't want that conversation on the page.
Right,
you get trolls, you get people who aren't interested in it, or just people who just want to complain and rant about it. And
your content's very uplifting, and it like I feel like it's very affirming.
And I'm like, girl, I don't need a speech about that. I'm a 40-something black woman, dark skin. Yes. I know all about it.
Yes.
Probably before you had an idea of it. So that's why I like to, you know, put the spinach in the peaches, as I say. I like to have uplifting content, mm-hmm. things. I never post like so-and-so died on this day. Because I just go, you know, we all know that Marvin Gaye is dead, but I post on his birthday, not
yes,
on his death
to celebrate.
Day. Yes, I celebrate their life. I don't go about, oh, they died today or they did this. I just try to have an interesting, or give you a little tidbit about them that you've never heard before.
Yes, and that's why I love what you do.
Do you know Lena Horne's Bergdorf story?
No, tell me.
Oh, God, well, she was a big fan of Bergdorf Goodman, according to her daughter. The reason, because at the time, in the early 40s, the Savoy was across the street from Bergdorf's at the time. And, you know, Miss Horn was a singer and actress, the whole thing, but she had these managers who were basically taking all her money. They were all, like, two managers taking 20% each, seriously, like something crazy like that.
Okay.
So she had no money. She was making money, but she didn't have any money.
Right.
So she needed gowns for her performances. And, of course, you know, you're Lena Horne. She has this image, but, you know, when you have the image and no money... I know all about that. But she, you know, she was kind of in a tough spot.
Right.
And so she went across the street to Bergdorf Goodman with her friend, Nuffy Calloway, who was Cab Calloway's wife.
Oh.
And I think his girlfriend at the time, maybe.
The Run for Revogue is where you'll meet all the most exciting people in fashion and culture.
I am Fran Lebowitz, who should be the mayor of New York.
We all support that. We support that.
Very nice.
Nikki.
Yes.
It's been really great being in this beautiful pink room.
All right, Usher, can you hear us?
I can hear you.
All right.
Can you hear me?
We can.
We can.
All right, here we are.
On the podcast, you'll learn how Vogue really works.
Sometimes we'll come in for a second or even third run through until we are AWOC.
Can you tell us what AWOC means?
It means AWOK, Anna Wintour OK.
I'm Cho Minardi.
And I'm Chloe Mel.
And we're the hosts of The Run Through with Vogue, where fashion and culture collide.
Join us. It's AWOC.
Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
But his wife of 50 years eventually. And they went shopping, and they were shopping for dresses, and, you know, there were so many pretty things that she liked, and... she just couldn't afford it. And so after a while, you know how you just do all the crazy math in your head and it just doesn't add up. And she's like, you know what? And the sales lady said, wait a second. And she went in the back. And a few minutes later, she came back with Andrew Goodman.
Like
Goodman.
Of Bergdorf Goodman. Yes. The guy. Yeah.
And he said, oh, Miss Horn, you know, we love you. You know, so why don't you just take your gowns, just put it on credit. And, you know, just take what you need and we'll just work something out.
Wow.
And she was a loyal customer from that point.
After that point.
On.
Is there a particular decade that you find yourself most drawn to? Like, for me, it's the 20s. I love the 20s, Jazz Age, Harlem Renaissance, Josephine Baker, obviously.
Yeah, I have to say, not really. People ask me that sometimes, and I think it's because I'm drawn to different people. In the different periods.
Okay.
And so I like some of the Harlem Renaissance people. I mean, who doesn't want to be in the Harlem Renaissance?
Exactly.
And like, in the real Harlem Renaissance, where you're going to the rent parties, where you're going to the gay clubs, where you're going to your white friend gets you into the white, your rich white friend gets you into the white clubs.
Right.
So the police won't carry you out.
Right,
you know?
Right.
You're going to just all, you know, the poetry readings, or you're going to the classical, whatever you're doing. You're going to the Broadway show.
Yeah.
You're going to see, earlier in the 20s, you're going to see Shuffle Along, but, that sweet spot.
Okay. Let me ask you a different way. Mm-hmm. If I name a decade, can you tell me who your favorite, most interesting person is from that decade?
Probably.
Okay. 20s.
Well, Josephine Baker, obviously.
Okay. Obviously. Yeah. 30s.
Maybe Freddie Washington.
Who's Freddie Washington?
Freddie Washington. Yeah, I don't know, actress and activist.
Okay.
Yeah, she is, you know, the soundbite on her is that she famously refused to pass for white in Hollywood.
Oh, but she was light-skinned, but she could have, and she refused.
Yes, she was in Imitation of Life in the 30s.
Okay, I know her.
Yeah, but she, yeah, of course, and she was in a lot of these great black soundies. You know, there's a cute one I posted on Vintage Black Glamour she did with Cab Calloway. She did some films with Paul Robeson.
Okay.
She was so light that they would put this ridiculous darker makeup
on her. To make her look black?
Yeah, and she did not. She looked like a light woman with makeup on her that kinda was too dark. It looks absurd. I don't post it. That's another thing I don't post because I don't want people who don't know what they're talking about.
The whole black
on
face.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, who was it that played Nina Simone? Zoe Saldana. And that looked, and I watched the film because I love Nina Simone, but I was like, no shade to Zoe. It just looked off. Do you know what I mean? Like,
I know exactly what you mean. I'm going to refrain from commenting.
Yes,
on
okay.
That
one. We can move on. Okay, 40s.
But I really, you know, the way she looked in that movie.
Yeah,
that's how they made Freddie Washington look in the 30s.
It's unnecessary. It's uncanny valley, isn't that what they call it? Like when you're like, this isn't quite right, but like
absurd.
I can't put my finger on it.
But you know, more than that, you know, Freddie Washington. She was also an activist. She was a one of the founders of, I think it was called the Negro Actors Guild.
Okay,
so one of the first, you know,
SAG for black people.
Essentially,
I'll tell you,
there was actually a SAG for black people before that. That's a whole nother one.
Okay.
But, I have like the Black History Encyclopedia.
Yeah.
I'll go on. But that one, the Negro Actors Guild, like Duke Ellington and Ethel Waters were on the board. And they were basically, they formed to fight against stereotypical images in film and on stage.
Wow.
And this was like in the 30s. And she was also a theater critic for a paper called The People's Voice.
Oh, wait, of course, yeah.
Which was founded by Adam Clayton Powell.
Yes.
Who was her brother-in-law at the time.
Wow.
But yeah, he was married to her sister, Isabel. But
that's
crazy. She was an interesting, fascinating lady.
I've got to
yes.
learn about her.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
She's in the book. You have my book. She's in the book. She has the armband on her. She's wearing a suit, and she has an anti-lynching armband on her arm.
Okay.
Yeah. But yeah, Freddie Washington was an interesting lady who would have gotten a lot more work, obviously, I'd say a decade or so later. I was going to say that, but then, you know, there was another actress who I posted today, the latest post on Vintage Black Glamour, is a Shakespeare clip from 73 with Rosalind Cash and an actress named Ellen Holly. And many people may be more familiar with Rosalind Cash. Some people know her as late as the soap operas like General Hospital and different things that she was on. She was in this great movie in the 80s, early 80s, called Sister, Sister with Diane Carroll and Iron Cara. But Ellen Holly wrote a book called One Life, the Autobiography of an African-American Actress, detailing her life as an actress. In the early 70s, late 60s, early 70s, she made history on TV because her character on a soap opera, One Life to Live, passed as white. They brought the character on and everyone was thinking she was white, and it made big news because when they finally revealed that she was black, you know, because she is Ellen. Now, so I'm, you know, looking at her so much, to me, I know Ellen Holly is black, so she looks black to me.
Okay.
But a lot of people look at her and say, is that Catherine Deneuve? It's like, no, that's...
No, I know. It's so weird to me though how people can't tell, like, who is this woman who made all the headlines because she pretended to be black? Why can't I remember her name? Rachel Dolezal.
Oh,
I look at pictures of her and I'm like, you are the braids, the tan, it doesn't, like, you were clearly a white
woman. Who were you fooling?
Yeah. Like, you were a white woman. There's, like,
really
not even...
And even in our context today, like, it's, you know, people today that we understand to be biracial, multiracial, whatever, in the 20s or the 30s, they could conceivably pass as white or something else because people weren't as used to seeing people in different...
Their eyes weren't trained.
Yeah, not as trained, white and black people. Well, black people more so, we could usually tell because we know there's always someone in our family. Everyone has a blue-eyed cousin or a green-eyed cousin. So that's, you know... There's always one cousin that people are like, oh, who are they? You know, my own sister is light-skinned. And people are like, is that your sister? I'm like, yeah.
Yeah, my brother's much lighter than I am.
And it's black, like, it's not, and she's clearly black, so why is it that hard to believe that she's my sister?
I know.
You know. So it's weird. People have these weird ideas now. So back then, you can get away with basically anything. If you're Mariah Carey in 1920.
You could just be a white woman. Interesting. What do you think it is about women of the past and men of the past that people could learn from today? Like, in terms of just like the style and elegance and glamour and the way that people carried themselves, because I think a lot of that is getting lost.
I think back then they had to be, even no matter what their means were, they had to be more inventive. A lot of things just weren't as readily available to them. So you had, and you know, And also they were kind of restricted in some ways, more restricted by societal pressures and whatever, unless they were, clearly trying to be an outlier or something. Otherwise, they had to just... They had to think about it more, I think, to be more interesting. They had to put the way they put themselves together. You can follow along in the 50s and wear the poodle skirt or wear whatever everyone else is wearing and look like everyone else. Mm-hmm. Or you could wear a shinier. So you can do something to make yourself stand out. But it really depended quite often on your station in life, on the circles that you ran in, on what you were trying to do. If you were a school teacher, but you really wanted to be an actress, maybe you are going to be wearing that sweater that none of the other girls wear.
Right.
And that was more of a big deal in 1948 than it would be in 2018.
Right. Right.
So, they had to be more inventive. They didn't have as much at their disposal as we do, no matter what our means are, even if you're wealthy
or poor. I kind of believe that having less gives you better style. It's almost like when you have too many options, your style just becomes...
I don't know about that. I think it's a... You know, some people have that thing. It's
true.
It's not even... I don't know that being
It's not
less,
more or less. It's just like some people just have style.
Yeah, some people, whether they have $5 or $5 million, they're going to be fab. They can do it. Mm-hmm. I can't do it on $5. So there are some people you just need to have certain basic things. And things used to be cheaper. So even to pull it together, you have to be more inventive and more clear.
Right.
It's good to have certain basics, to have certain things, to have the simple black dress, to have the slacks, to have the crisp white shirt, the little things that you can do that you think about. When you're younger, you're coming into your own style and you're thinking about different things.
Right.
But if you're in the previous decades, they operated under a smaller box. They had more restrictions than we did. So the ones that really stood out to us that were more interesting, they just kind of did things. They were in that box, sort of, but they also kind of, maybe they're, the pocket.
Had a little bit of flourish.
Had a flourish.
The
tie was interesting. The fabric.
Yes.
They just did things along those lines, I think. Yeah.
Yes. Give me 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s.
I mean, I guess Lena Horne, if you come through the 40s, okay. Lena Horne and Catherine Dunham.
Oh, I don't know her.
Catherine Dunham is the dance legend.
Okay.
Yeah, so she came along, she in Stormy Weather, everyone knows Lena Horne pinned to the pillar singing Stormy Weather.
Yes.
And right after that, in that same dance number, is Catherine Dunham and her troupe doing this fabulous dance. And she founded a company called, I think it's called Ballet Negre. I just posted about her the other day as well.
Yeah.
She founded, of course, the Catherine Dunham Dance Company, and one of her early charges was Eartha Kitt.
Oh.
And so there's a great picture I have of Eartha Kitt from like 1948 or so when she was a young Dunham dancer. She lived in Harlem, and she would take classes there. And her first film appearance was as a Dunham dancer in this movie called Cairo, I think, from like the late 40s, 47, 48.
I've heard of that movie.
So yeah, you. She at that time, you have an anthropology PhD, and you go to Jamaica and Haiti and learn their dances and bring them back to America and incorporate, these African, these Caribbean dances into classical ballet and the so-called respectable ones that people, automatically respect and look at as quality, as the top tier.
Yes.
It's kind of like black musicians, that know classical music as in white classical traditions.
Right. And then they take
it. And then they go to Morocco or Africa. So you have that.
Right.
So we've always had people like that.
Of course. People are surprised to learn that Basquiat was classically trained in art. He's like, I can do the Renaissance painting style.
It's interesting you say that, because just like they're surprised that Basquiat was classically trained, they're surprised that athletes who were, they think, you have it natural.
It's very offensive.
No, athletes have to work their ass off. That's why they're on your television, because there are 100 other guys that could, and women or whatever, that could, that wish they can do that, whatever, but it's the work that they put in.
Absolutely.
That they, that blood, the blood, sweat, and tears.
Yeah.
Musicians that are classically trained. Roberta Flack, people that, if you hear them, if you hear pop radio or whatever, and they're surprised. Bernadette Stanis, Thelma on Good Time, she went to Juilliard.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So, I mean, people don't, people have this idea. They see you in this one thing. You must be.
Born with it. Have you been, I'm sure the answer is yes. Have you been to the African American Museum in D.C.?
Yes. The minute I came back from Asia, I went there. I booked my ticket. I was in Korea, and I went online and made sure I got a ticket because I heard they were selling out.
Yeah. So, isn't it incredible?
It's amazing. I have to go back because,
yeah, I want to go back too.
I didn't see the mothership. I had, you know, Parliament and Funkadelic. I had, so I don't know, because you're in there for so long.
Did you start at the bottom and go up?
I did.
Well, we should explain for people also that don't know. It's almost like a chronological museum experience. So it starts with slavery and then kind of goes through slavery, reconstruction, civil rights era, and then like the top floor is kind of current day, like music, culture, fashion, stuff like
exactly.
that. But yeah,
so and I gave that the short. I went through the, and I'm glad I started that
me
way.
Me too.
Because when I go back, I'll kind of start in the middle more and, you know, like the 20th century basically and kind of go up so I can take in more because I also didn't see Prince's thing and I'm a Prince girl and so I'm like, how did I, you know, but I didn't have time because I had to get my train.
Oh my gosh. We got there at 9 a.m. Like as soon as the doors opened, we got there and it closed and we had just done everything. I mean, it's a real experience.
Yeah. You can't do it once. You have to go back at least twice. I mean, someone like me, I have to go like three times, I'm sure, but to really take it in because I'll go through everything. I read the captions, you know.
Oh yeah.
I was happy to see, you know, obviously Harry Tubman's shawl or
Ida B. Wells.
I think they had teacups from her or something. You know, a lot of the club women, the ladies from the late 19th century and the early 20th that I talk about in the early chapter of Vintage Black Glamour. So I wanted to, the thing about history is that that's why I like things like Drunk History.
Yes.
Comedy Central.
Yes.
Because it brings history to the people. It's interesting, and however you need to take it in, even if that's the first way you learn about it, maybe you'll go look it up and learn
yes
more.
And do some more research on your own. Yeah,
so I like, you know, I like making history accessible to people.
The thing that I also found so interesting was seeing there were a lot of white people at the museum, obviously. And families with young kids, like 6 years old, 7 years old. And I, you know, we talked about how we can't like look at gory stuff. Look, all of the lynching sections, like I was literally like covering, I'm aware of lynching. It's horrible. I just don't want to see those images because I find them to be just too graphic and disturbing.
And I've seen enough of it. I don't need to take it in all the time to be reminded of it.
Exactly.
And this, even before the internet and everything, when I would read a lot and as a teenager and as a young adult and everything, sometimes they'd have those pictures in the book.
Yeah. And you're like,
and so you, or you know, now it's like you can go on, now the kids are going online.
Right.
And obviously they're not going in books like we were, but I've seen enough of it. I don't need to keep looking at lynching pictures to be aware of what it is.
What
so I understand,
happening.
But some people do need to see it. I'm not saying it needs to be suppressed or anything, obviously, but yeah.
There was something just to me so powerful about watching these young white kids going through it with their families because they were asking so many questions. Like I remember in the first bottom part, we were with this family and the boy must have been like 7, 8 years old and he kept asking his parents like, why did they do this to these people? Why did they do this? And she's like, well, it was for money. And he's like, but how could they be okay with this? It's so sick. Like, you know, but I felt like it was such
a... I hope he grows up and runs a business or runs for office or something.
Yeah, I mean, but you could just, you know, his naivete, he was just like, I don't understand why this ever happened. Mm-hmm. And I thought, good for the parents for not feeling like, oh, it's too much. He's too young. He can't see this. I think it's so important for kids of all races to understand.
Exactly. And you said, you know, white people were there. Of course white people were there. White people have always been interested in all kinds of things about us from beginning. It's been kept from them quite a bit.
Yes.
You know, so in some instances, yeah, they'll go. If you're a Carl Van Mechten, you're going to go with your black friends to the party or in Harlem or whatever. Yeah. A lot of that, you know, little snippets like that.
Yeah.
There are some white people, obviously, who are not interested at all. And then there are all white people that are interested in just about anything. It's like, oh, okay, hey, let's check this out. They don't have a preconceived notion of it. And if you're not training just like I said earlier, how my mother didn't say, oh, you know, Polish people are like this or Jewish people are like, if you don't train your kids to have that mindset, they're not going to go. So anytime if a kid is all of a sudden coming up with the N-word, they heard that from somewhere.
Right. Yes. It's not,
you know,
it's learned.
Not, yeah. Did they learn it online or did they learn it from their kitchen over breakfast? You know, I always tell the quick story when I was, when I came to New York initially, I was an editorial assistant at Woman's Day magazine.
Okay.
And there was a woman, this is really random, but I was having a conversation with this woman and she was talking about, oh, you know how Jewish people are. So white woman. And so I'm like, Jew. And I said to her, how do you know she's Jewish? She was talking about a particular woman. And she's, well, you know her name, duh. And I'm thinking to myself, ooh. And I'm maybe 21 or 20 years old. And I didn't, at that time, now, of course, I would know a name like Rosenstein or whatever. Like right, certain right. things I would obviously guess.
Right.
But I had no idea. But did, I
you
did
weren't
not
screening
know.
People that way,
I
right.
I was not screening people. And no, I didn't know. And,
right.
And I didn't have anything snarky. And I was not like, look, I did not have a problem with this woman because she was Jewish or anything else.
Right.
So for her to say all that, so I'm thinking, what are you saying about me?
Me, right.
When I'm not there, because I had no idea about this, that this was a thing.
Right.
And actually
right.
asked my friend, and it was like a dumb question, quote unquote, dumb question to ask, you know, the type of yeah. thing you... But I mean, I didn't know. So if I didn't know, because if I was not raised like that, like, oh, right. Jewish people or Polish people or right. whatever. Now, you're raised, obviously, because... racism and systemic racism, all that is a thing. It's mm-hmm. affected whether people are nice or not, they're benefiting from it. Some, you know, white people of any stripe. But it's like, if you're not training your kid to have these specific things, it's not coming out. So the kid in the museum, the white kid that's going, like, it doesn't make good. If it's not making sense
yes.
to them, you're doing
that's
a great
good.
Job,
yes,
mom and dad.
Exactly.
It made, or it dad actually, and dad or mom and
yes.
whatever.
No, it was honestly like one of... It's one of the things that I remember most about the museum experience, just his utter confusion and like, and he asked upstairs, so it's still going on? It's still happening? They're still
yes,
doing
Tommy,
this?
Yes, Tommy, it's still going
like,
on.
Yes, like, this is American history. It's not even black history. American history.
It's worldwide history.
Well,
it's
yes.
global history.
It's global history.
And once mm-hmm. I worked in print magazines for the longest time. Like I said, I was...
You were at GQ?
Yeah, I was at GQ. I was an assistant editor at GQ in the late 90s. I was an assistant editor for grooming and fitness, not beauty. You know, it's so interesting. So
yeah,
that's why it's so fascinating to see all this stuff now. I love seeing all the, there's so many black beauty and fashion editors now that just was not, they were like three of us back then.
I know.
And there was like one, there was like Mickey Taylor at Essence, who was like the big
yes.
honcho at Essence. And then there was, even like in the late, there would be an editor here and there. There was Corinne, there was just so few.
So few.
And now there's so many on Instagram. I'm like, who is this girl?
Yes.
Oh my God. I'm just like, on Instagram, like, oh my God, yes, yes.
I mean,
yes,
it's about time.
They were always there, though. They were all there. I mean, I'm glad to see these girls now. I mean, not to say girls, because I know. I mean, I'm talking about girls your age, probably, or like 30s or whatever. Mm-hmm. But man, in the late 90s, even, there was just not, you know, I would be the only black editor at these beauty lunches or whatever,
yeah.
you know? Or sometimes you see another one. It was always like, they'd say, oh, you're from Essence? You know, they all, you know. Because, you know, generally it would be, unless
right.
they already knew Mickey.
Right, right. That's like a Viacom would be like, oh, do you work at BET? And I was like, no.
Yeah.
I'm just black. I don't work at BET.
And I would get what I would call the, oh, you're black face. You know, they would come, they would have... I don't know what they do now because I'm old now, I guess, apparently. But, you know, they would have what you call desk sides, whereas the
oh,
PR...
Oh, yeah. No, that's... Oh, that still happens. I've interviewed beauty editors, and
yeah.
they told me about it, yeah.
Yeah, they the PR folks would come and visit you at your desk, whatever, with their products or brand or whatever yeah. it is, and they would either have lunch with them or they'd come to your desk, literally. And I would go out to reception at many time and greet someone.
They would be very surprised. Like,
hi.
Oh!
Because at GQ, you're not expecting a black woman. It's a
no,
human,
not
so.
At all. Yeah.
And like, you know, and I was not, you know, I was just, I very much look like the black woman writer that I am. I was not, like
this
fashion plate, you know, even at GQ. So it was, so they were like, oh, okay. And it was interesting. But yeah, I don't know. That was a fun time at GQ. It was really interesting.
Yeah.
But yeah, that beauty, I mean, I worked there and I was at Woman's Day and I lost my train of thought. I was saying something else where I was coming. The black editors.
Yes.
There were just so few. The only time you really saw them were like newspaper reporters, like at that time, or some of the, or here and there. My friend Denine was an editor at Parenting
okay.
magazine. I think.
When did Andre Leon Talley kind of come on the scene?
Well, he came on like in the late 70s, early 80s.
Okay.
He was initially, I think he wrote for Ebony and different things at first, but also he got his start in high fashion that we know now with Diana Vreeland.
Yes.
And so she's
my other coffee table, like, goddess icon. Like, I just think she's so
yeah,
fabulous.
Exactly. He started out working with her, and I know he came along. I know he did some work with Eunice Johnson. That's what I'm saying,
okay.
with Ebony.
Yes.
Yeah. But by the time he got to Vogue and everything, I think that was around the 80s or so. But again, the only one that everyone kind of knows.
Knew.
There's always some here and there. That's why it's so great to see Edward and at British Vogue.
Yes.
Love.
I know.
All of this stuff that's going on there because, you know, as a teenager, I'm growing up and I'm looking at all the black models at that time. Like, obviously, well, the ones... people still know Iman and Beverly Johnson. And there were models at the time like Kirstie Bowser and Alva Chen. And, you know, Shari Belafonte was even a model then. Harry Belafonte's daughter. She was on a few covers of Vogue. There is a book, Barbara Summers, the late, great Barbara Summers, really nice lady. She passed a few years ago. I'm glad I got a chance to meet her. She wrote, like, the definitive book on black models.
Oh, I'll have to see that, too.
Yeah, yeah. And so you have to get that book. I think it's called Black and Beautiful. They changed the name of it. The original name was something else. But Naomi Campbell's on the cover of it.
Yeah.
But it was, I think she put it out, like, about a decade ago now. But she was a model herself in, like, the 70s and 80s. Yeah. She was a Ford model for years. And so she knew all the models.
Oh, that's
all
so funny. I was signed to Ford as a teenager and quit my career at, you know, the old age of 18 years old.
Well, everyone can't say that, so that's fabulous. So
I have two final questions for you. The first question is, I'm sure there are a lot of people listening that have passions or things they're interested in, just as you were interested in history, and you found a way to create a lane for yourself where this is now what you do, and it's the focus of your life. And I'm sure it's very fulfilling, right, to be able to tell these stories and to share this information with people. If you are a young person and you know that you're passionate about something, but you don't necessarily see like a clear way of making money doing it, or you just don't even know how to start, what advice would you give them in terms of just like beginning and having the conviction to know that you can do it?
It's interesting because the money thing, it really depends on the person, because it's always not that. Yes, it's true that money is not everything, but it's helpful. So I'm not saying that you need to you need money to pursue your dreams. You can have money and not do it well, and not do it right, or not have go about it the right way. You can have all the resources in the world and just not have the right thing. So if you know you're interested in something or whatever, learn about it. Just do all the research that you can. Like, you know, listen, even people that may or may not appeal to you. And now there's so many resources now. There's podcasts now. There's obviously websites and articles. If you don't have to, like, you know, drag yourself to the library like I did.
The Schomburg. Yeah.
The Schomburg, or even as a teenager, my local library as a kid, and I would read books there or go through, you know, I would read biographies of Lauren Bacall and Diane Carroll and things like that.
Yes.
And so there, you have so many resources at your hand. If you know you like fashion design, look at Vogue's site. I think Vogue has some of their archives online. You know, look at some of that. If you read an article and someone you admire mentions something, or they mention a person you've never heard of, look that person up.
Yes, that's great advice.
Do that. Yeah, look, that's what I would do when I would read books. Like, the reason I'm a writer is because of Maya Angelou. As a kid, reading her books, and I read her books. Like, I think I can do this. I would like to write.
Yes.
And, you know, I like Judy Blume as well, but Maya Angelou was really the one that really spoke to me. So reading her books, and then she would mention someone I never heard of, I would look them up.
Yes.
And at that time, I had to go into the card catalog people, you know, go to the physical library. I couldn't just whip out my phone and type their name.
Right.
Now you can. So look up these people. If you haven't heard of them, or if you see someone who's famous and they're being honored, if you're watching the Grammys and you see Patti LuPone and you finally realize that they're not talking about Patti LaBelle,
you're like, oh, who is this person?
Look her up.
Right. Yes.
Look these people up, you know. Pay attention. If you know you like architecture, if you know, you know, you like wine, there's so many, there's an embarrassment of riches now.
Yes.
So you can't, don't go too far. Don't get too scatterbrained where you're unfocused. And, you know, so I would just say kind of hone in, look up people, look up.
It's great advice.
Know. Yeah. You know.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I kind of studied podcasts as a listener for a while before I,
Best way to do it.
Yeah. Launched my own. Okay, last question, and I'm interested to know your opinion just as kind of a historian and someone who looks at history. How do you think that this time, this crazy Trump era time that we're living in, from the perspective of not just black history, but like, how do you think we'll look back at this time like 50 years from now? Do you think it will be seen as a time of like resistance and turmoil, kind of like how the late 60s was?
As long as we have the media out there that's available, as long as it's not suppressed, you know, there's
true.
A lot of
A lot could happen in 50 years.
There's a lot of, you know, independent media and local media being bought up by
Oh, I know, these crazy conglomerates that are, have exactly, right-wing agendas. It's scary.
Exactly. They're just buying up all these media sources. So that's why it's really important for people to be aware of where they're getting their information from and yes, be aware of who owns that information, whether they're, you know, whatever their background is. You know, yeah, look at all of it, yeah, but make sure it's available. So as long as the information is available, yes, absolutely, you can't help but see the resistance. You need to see both sides of it and see, or see all sides of it, right?
Right.
You can see, you know, and from an American perspective, from a global perspective. It really depends on the information that's available, because there's so much history now that people say, oh, I didn't know that. Whether it's something light that I post on Vintage Black Glamour and people say, oh, I've never heard of this person.
Right.
Of course you didn't hear about it because they didn't put her in Life magazine.
Right.
You know, and Ebony magazine didn't come along until like 1945. And they could only put, Ebony was just one magazine.
Right.
So you could only, it's one issue you can only do with so much in so many years,
right,
obviously.
Right.
So there were a lot of people that were famous for decades but forgotten.
Yes,
and so there, you have to. It really depends on the media and the history that's available, the library archives. You know,
yes,
just make sure this all, as long as it. And, but you know what? I think a lot of it. I think we'll be in good shape in 50 years because a lot of things are digitized.
Yes,
and so whatever your agenda is, there are a lot of people saving it there and now. I think it may be the Committee to Protect Journalists. Something I just read recently where they're starting to archive a lot of digital sources that have been. In danger of being bought up by these sources that we were saying, like a Gawker and the other ones,
oh, wow,
buying up their archives so they can't, so these people can't buy these archives and erase it. There's enough people around the world that have had access now already who are already recording things, and
yes,
we're much better now at recording. Back then in the 20s, 30s, 40s, whether you're white, black, or whatever, everyone wasn't always thinking in terms of what people are going to read 50 years from now.
Right. Yes.
You know,
right,
in some cases, they would have hidden some things. Think
yes, that's true.
You know,
that's very true.
Yeah.
I think there are a lot of films that need to be made about the people that you write about that just haven't been made. And I think about how many kind of mainstream / white people there are films about, and it can be like the smallest, like, not, I don't want to say insignificant, everyone's story is significant, but like when I think about, like, we were talking about Danielle Luna, the first black supermodel, fascinating life. She was hanging out with like Fellini and she was doing all these crazy types of drugs, and like, I mean, her life just sounds so fascinating to me, and I read about her life and I'm like, I can't believe there's not a movie about this woman. Or
there's so many people different. Yeah, and it's funny because the thing is, there's not a movie about it because, first of all, movies are always so hard to make. But when you're not the one telling the story, if you don't have the resources now, you can pull out your iPhone and tell a story. You can, you know,
right,
I can put out, you know, Vintage Black Glamour and tell,
yeah,
a story about somebody.
I love the Instagram stories
out
you're doing now. Everyone should, if,
oh,
if everyone listening should,
I'm trying
go
to do
follow
something different. With
no, it's great
with Instagrams because people, Instagram stories is so like, you know, so like glossy now. Everyone is the, you know. So instead of just throwing a picture up, I'm trying to find either an interesting clip. It's hard,
no,
to find,
it's
because
great,
it's not, it's Vintage Black Glamour. I don't own these things. So like a lot of people, I'm getting them from YouTube or wherever.
Yeah.
So I want, and you only have like 10, 12 seconds,
yeah,
right?
Very short amount of time.
As far as
story.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm trying to think of the interesting ways to put things in Instagram stories that I don't have, that I maybe can't put on the timeline because not enough time,
right,
and to make it interesting and to keep people's interest. So
mm-hmm,
you want to do as much. And I know Instagram has changed their algorithm so much.
Oh,
and so
I know. Yeah,
you have to, people will see a post the next day or 12
yes
hours later.
Oh my gosh, sometimes I see stuff from like 5 days ago. I'm like, why am I seeing this now?
Why? And sometimes I look specifically for a person just so I can look at their timeline because I missed it.
Because you've missed it. Yeah, of course.
Yeah,
of course.
So it's so, yeah.
We talked about the goddesses, Eartha, Josephine, Lena, and Dorothy Dandridge.
Mm-hmm.
Who do you think 50 years from now people will say are the goddesses of now?
Oprah.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah, because all around.
Mm-hmm.
Oprah's, I mean, the
Oprah's,
way...
Oprah's, I mean, everything she's like.
And there's enough media to... I mean, if there was an Oprah from 100 years ago, her picture would be in my book. I just
yes
couldn't get a good, clear picture of Madam C.J. Walker, say.
Right, right.
But, you know, there okay I do have Rose Morgan in my book, who was the beauty entrepreneur. She's the one who's doing my aunt's hair in the book.
Oh.
She did all the celebrities, Lena Horne, all the big celebrities
okay
went to her salon
okay
in Harlem.
She was like the Nikki Nelms of that
she
time.
She was the celebrity hair. She
yes
was a millionaire. beauty entrepreneur.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. And so, and she was like her second, she was Joe Louis's second wife as well. So she had a celebrity athlete. Yeah. Well, after his prime or whatever, but still, she was, you know, you had the Rose Morgans, you had Ophelia DeVore, who's also in my book. Ophelia DeVore started out as a model and she owned her own modeling agency for a time. And she was also an activist. She protested to get more black models and advertising and different things. And she, you know, put her money where her mouth is. So you had those people. And so someone like Oprah who came, you know, out of, you know, I remember, my gosh, as a teenager, when Oprah first came out, children, when we were young, I liked Oprah initially because she was a Maya Angelou fan. I'm like, oh, wow. You know, because she reads and she likes Maya Angelou. She's different. I like this Oprah.
Yes, yes.
I like her. And keep in mind, it was a big deal when her talk show went national. Now, everyone thinks Oprah was always national.
Oh,
she started
in
Chicago.
Yes.
And then once it was syndicated, you could finally see it because I would read about her in all the magazines, but her show was not.
Yes.
So once it became national, then you could finally see Oprah's show.
Yes. One of my favorite podcasts is Making Oprah, where that goes through the whole.
Yeah, I like that one.
Like how she.
That was a great podcast.
And you know they're doing a new season with Barack Obama.
Oh,
I know.
Yes.
I was like, what?
Yay.
This is crazy. What about like a Beyonce or like...
Oh, absolutely.
So Beyonce you think would be one of the goddesses. Okay, so Beyonce,
absolutely.
Oprah, anyone else?
Beyonce, Oprah, like the ones that are huge like that, like neon signs, like the Beyonce, Oprah, Michelle Obama, the satellite, they'll be...
Yes.
People like, who else? Halle Berry.
Halle Berry, yes.
Absolutely. Serena Williams.
Oh, I love Serena
Williams. Because, again, because not just... She broke through athletically... again, growing up, tennis playing. We heard about Althea Gibson.
Yes.
Zena Garrison was a tennis player in the late 80s. There were some black tennis players that came through here and there. But the way, you know what, Serena and Venus just kept winning and winning and winning.
Yeah.
When you're undeniable, that's when you're...
Yes.
You know, and that's a shame because that's our threshold. We have to, you know...
Yes.
We have to be undeniable.
We have to break every single record that exists to be...
Right. Yeah. If you're a Latino, you know, if you're Lin-Manuel Miranda, like, you got to like, you have to be like...
You have to make Hamilton to...
Yes.
Yes.
Like, he's undeniable. So 50 years from now, you'd be looking at him. But as far as the women, you'll see, like I said, the Halle Berry... I said, obviously, Beyonce, Rihanna, you know, it's like, you know, Nina Mae McKinney. I mean, people now, there's a lot of good YouTube videos and pictures. And so now people, you know, she was kind of like the Rihanna of her day, you know, again, going to all the crazy parties in Hollywood, black and white, gay and straight and everything in between.
Yes.
And the drugs, the parties, the people, the, you know, dating Shebas and Sheiks or whatever. I mean, the whole, that's, I mean, talk about a movie.
Yes, I know.
Someone doing her, you know, I mean, there's so many people, but again, we've been, you know, that's why people are so unaware of it. That's why people, you know, initially in the beginning, people will say, well, why does it have to be vintage black glamour?
Okay.
And I'm like, well, how many Hollywood books do you have on your coffee table and how many black people are in it? They don't even have the basics like Lena Horne and Dorothy Dandridge.
Yes.
You might have a book with Josephine Baker in her banana skirt. And I love the banana skirt, Brooke, but I have to say, little thing, especially initially with that, I love everything about Josephine Baker.
Yes.
Because...
But they
talk about undeniable and being yourself, and especially in... obscene rejection.
Oh.
Not just the racism, but of, say, your own race. You're not doing what a woman's supposed to do. You're not doing what a black woman is supposed to do.
Everything.
You're not doing what a poor woman's supposed to do, whatever. Why don't you, you know, quote unquote, whatever.
Yes.
So if you're Josephine Baker and it's 1925 and you're being Josephine Baker, God bless you. And I love the banana skirt, but the reason I didn't have it in the book and the reason I didn't do that is because that's a thing that everyone sees it. I ask people, have you seen it before? Then you won't see it in vintage black glamour.
Ooh, I like that as a point of differentiation.
If you notice in the pictures of her in my book, she's already in her 30s and 40s.
Yes, and some of the pictures of her that you've put in your book are pictures that I had never seen before. So I appreciate that. I agree with you about the banana skirt, especially because she was marketed as a savage. I mean, isn't the name of that performance where she was on the...
The Savage.
Yeah.
She was also participating in it, because think about it. It's like Washerwoman in St. Louis or that, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And she was in Harlem and she was, you know, doing, you know, I mean, look, I don't blame. It's like the step and fetch.
Yeah, she's like, I'll put on this banana skirt. Fine. Pay me my money.
I don't judge the people those days. I don't judge her.
Yeah.
I don't judge Step and Fetch It, which his real name is Lincoln Perry, you know, doing his thing, because they did what they had to do. And
they broke down barriers to a degree as well.
For better or for worse, that's exactly what they did. Mm-hmm. Bill Robinson, all the people that we have, you know, the people in our history who some people have problems with because of their portrayals or who they associated with, whatever, whether it's Sammy Davis and Eartha Kitt. They like to talk about that. They don't talk about how Sammy Davis and Eartha Kitt had to put their own money into promoting Anna LaCosta when that movie came out.
Oh, I didn't know
the
that.
The Southern theaters wouldn't play it because they said it was too racy and it, you know, basically, it's Anna LaCosta. She's, you know, she's basically playing a woman who's a prostitute, like her, and she was molested as a child and all these deep, you know, themes that came about. When Anna LaCosta first came out, I think in the '30s, like late '30s, it was the play, I think it was, I want to say Philip Yordan. I'm blanking on so many names today, but obviously it was a white cast that did it first. And then on Broadway, they had a black cast and Hilda Sims and other actors did it. When that movie finally came out, the censors were still, they were loosening up some, but not as much. And so they had a lot of problems with that. So Sammy Davis and Eartha Kitt had to write letters to these Southern theater owners saying this movie is not this a disgrace. I forget, like, the absurd things that people don't think about now that, I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of things that go on behind the scenes now that people are like, what, you're doing that in 2018? But believe me, in 1958, you had to do that. If you're Harry Belafonte and you're producing Odds Against Tomorrow, and you know, and you're trying to maybe also Odds Against Tomorrow was a film noir that he produced.
Oh, I don't know about it.
Oh yeah, yeah. That's another clip. Young Cicely Tyson is in that movie. Oh, okay. Carmen de Lavallade.
Oh, isn't really?
Yeah, okay. Cicely Tyson was the bartender, and Carmen de Lavallade was like his love interest.
Okay.
Robert Earl Jones was in it. James Earl Jones' father. Gosh. So there's a lot of things.
There's just so much history. I think that Black Americans, actually Black people, I mean, there's just a very rich history, and there is
But now it's available to us because of the internet and also YouTube, because especially I started Vintage Black Glamour online in January 2011. It's been 7 years now. And initially, when I would look for pictures initially because I didn't want to post things that people had already posted. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the pictures, I know I was the first one to post.
Of course, yeah.
And so then a lot of people would tag it later and like, oh my God, it's so amazing. And I'm like,
yes. No, but you've done like a huge service just for the preservation of these images, because imagine if you didn't scan
I hope so. I mean, I'm glad now a lot of things are so much more available. A lot of libraries have their archives online now.
I know.
So when I was doing, like I told you about the time when I was in the Schomburg researching my book.
Physically doing it all.
Family, I had to go, when I was in Chicago, I had to go to the Chicago Public Library to look into their archives and look into the microfiche and look up the Chicago Defender and the papers. When I was in Los Angeles, I went to the Los Angeles Public Library. I would go there. Now you don't have to do that. You can go online, and a lot of these things are that I had to fly for, now they're right there. So all these people, they're, you know, screen, you know, these scripts, I'm writing scripts now. There, if you want to write a book or a movie, or you have an idea about something, there's so many people that someone has never heard of. There's 50 Martin Luther King movies or Rosa Parks, and why not? There's been, you know,
yeah.
But it's been done.
There are other stories that need to be told.
So many other stories that no one's and there's a couple of ideas that I always keep in my back pocket that I'm doing now, and I always check and see if anybody's doing it. And I'm like, wow, they're still not doing it. Interesting.
Yes. Okay. Well, I thank you for your work, and I thank you for coming on the show. We should do a little cheers.
Cheers. Thank you, Brooke.
I feel like I have so many people I have to like look into now.
Oh yeah. Well, you know, I don't know if I'll email you, whatever's better.
Send me everything. Everyone listening, please, please go. You can get all of Nichelle's books. She has two out.
Yes, two. Yeah, Vintage Black Glamour and Vintage Black Glamour Gentleman's Quarters, which is exactly what it sounds like. It's the men's edition.
It's the men's. And I need to get that one, actually, because I don't have that one yet. But these books are such a pleasure to have. I have mine on my coffee table. I just, like, on weekends, I'll just kind of, like, sit here and I'll just open it, and it'll make me happy every single time. It's not something that you, like, read once and you're done with. And then when my guests come over, they always want to see it because it's, like, these beautiful stories and images, and it's just, like, such a special thing. So I thank you so much for coming on the show. And thanks, guys, for listening.
Hey, Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.